WBZ H910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Deadly storms in the past 24 hours now blamed for at least 23 deaths in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia. It included a tornado outbreak. ABC's Alex Stone is in Clear Creek, Indiana.
Deadly storms from the heartland to the East Coast, bringing heavy floods, powerful winds, large hail, and tornadoes to over 90 million Americans.
A new round of storms targeting the Southwest and Mid-Atlantic states today and through the weekend. President Trump, in a social media post, says he plans to speak with Russia's President Vladimir Putin Monday. That after direct talks between Ukraine and Russian delegations ended in Turkey with no progress on a peace deal. Russia carrying out deadly drone strikes in Ukraine overnight. In Rome, crowds are expected to pack into St. Peter's Square tomorrow for the formal installation of Pope Leo, the first American pope will lead Mass in St. Peter's Basilica. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio will be there. This is ABC News. Five people now under arrest. Police say the suspects are believed to be linked to an organized crime ring from Colombia.
Police in Irvine, California say they have five people in jail on charges including burglary.
Everything was on the floor. Literally everything.
Homeowner Guolin Wong says he was targeted by the group and lost tens of thousands of dollars worth of valuables.
Jewelry, gong, handbags, cash. Collectibles.
But he was able to catch them on security cam dressed as delivery workers. Mike Dubosky, ABC News.
Singer Cassie Ventura, the ex-girlfriend of Sean Diddy Combs, concluded testimony Friday in the sex trafficking and racketeering trial against the music mogul. Ventura spent 4 days on the stand telling jurors Combs allegedly abused her and coerced her to take part in sex parties. His defense argues that the sex was consensual. Combs has also pleaded not guilty to charges. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
An unsuspecting driver at a gas station in Wisconsin.
Welcome, Pump 15. How you doing?
Great.
Were you wearing your seatbelt today?
I never wear my seatbelt.
We're going to get him. We're going to get him real good.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, sir. How you doing? Dollar driver. It takes 1 second to strap a seatbelt on. Well, let's do this. Let's do it together. Now, don't that feel better?
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways.
And I should have recognized your voice when you're harassing
I'm watching you.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
Matt Nair on air.
Corrine Hendrickson, she owns a daycare center.
We're doing this day without childcare. What we do is we talk about what would happen, what would it look like if we didn't have childcare. But we also talk about what could it be? What can we do to change the system? I love all the protests. I love all the people speaking out against things. But we also need to participate in democracy by saying what we want and what we need and talk to our reps that way. So that's what this event is all about.
Catch Matt Nair on air at its new time. Weekday mornings, 9 to 11 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Lots to talk about. Trump's big birthday bash, the big, beautiful birthday bash, and the Army's 250th anniversary. Going to have a big celebration. As many as 25 tanks rolling through Washington, D.C. to celebrate the Donald and, of course, well, the Army as well. And look, what could go wrong? And it's only going to cost somewhere between $25 and $45 million while we're talking about gutting Medicaid and we're talking about slashing Social Security and taking food out of the mouths of children. But hey, we should have a big parade. Now, what I think will be interesting, because tanks weigh a lot, what happens if the ground swallows one of them up? I know if you roll one of those through the streets of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I got to tell you, I think it's underground fairly quickly. But it'll be interesting to see. Also, interesting bit of Trump administration news. Evidently, they're gutting grants to study online misinformation because they're engaging in lots of, well, propaganda and misinformation. By the way, the big, beautiful jet, this is the Flying Fortress. Evidently, Kristi Noem wants one, too. Evidently, the secretary over at Homeland Security, former governor of South Dakota, she wants a $50 million brand new Gulfstream 5 for her personal travel. They've tucked that neatly into the Coast Guard budget. So it should be interesting to see how that plays out. Now, understand, You go with the big, beautiful plane, the corruption there. You go to the fact that, Don Jr. has got that 1789, hedge fund that he's raising just untold amounts of money. You look at the fact that it's been reported that Trump's making billions off of his crypto and all kinds of craziness. So when Fox News weighs in, Bret Baier said that the media, of which I don't know if he's a part of, should 100% scrutinize Donald Trump's family as they did to Joe Biden. But our friends over at Media Matter kind of looked at Baier and said he hasn't come close to doing anything himself. So interesting position to take, given the fact that Trump, by far the most corrupt president, in my view, in the history of this country. Now, if I ever get into trouble, someone remind me that I don't want Mike Johnson to defend me. Because Mike Johnson was asked about Trump's corruption. And he said, the reason that many people refer to the Bidens as the Biden crime family is because they were doing all this stuff behind curtains and back rooms. They were trying to conceal it. Most of that made up stuff. He went on to say, whatever President Trump is doing is out in the open. They're not trying to conceal anything. President Trump has had to hide nothing. He's very upfront about his corruption. He's very upfront about it. And this is one of those things where Bill Kristol, I think I had the right response. This is a defensive admission. This is, we know he's doing it, but at least he's doing it right in front of us. For instance, Trump and Kushner got a hotel project in Serbia. It's kind of hit a snag. $500 million luxury hotel project in Serbia. Interestingly enough, the site that they were going to use, a bombed out defense ministry building, turns out one of the key documents the Serbian government has relied on to be able to make this deal go forward, evidently it's been forged. That's pretty interesting. And also, on Thursday, the big news was United Health Group kind of in trouble. Their stock plunging. In fact, back in December, their stock was north of $600 a share. Now, as of Thursday, dropped to about $252. Massive, massive decline. Because now it's come out, the Wall Street Journal has said that they're being investigated for alleged Medicare fraud, which is a big freaking deal. Maybe someone should regulate that. Maybe someone should be paying attention to what I've been saying for a while is going to be Medicare's replacement, because United Health Group is one of the largest insurers under the Medicare Advantage, the privatized Medicare. And now we're finding out more and more people who are actually using it. They love the free sneakers and the, I got a rebate, and they got, prescription drug prices lowered. But they're finding when they actually need help and helping. And they also are finding that the people that come to help them are actually kind of spying on them and upcoding their ailments so that United Health Group can cash in a little more. Again, not about health care, about health insurance and profit. So I'll tell you, I find it very interesting that we have an investigation now. Now I'm going to assume that these were Biden era folks who were looking into this, and who knows what Trump's going to do. But to me, this is another one of those moments where we do need cops on the beat. We need a strong government to oversee these kind of massive behemoth corporations. Now, I understand. Look, the CEO was shot back in December, and I know people are free to Luigi. I'm on that camp myself sometimes. I've been saying for a long time, this Medicare Advantage was a bad idea from the start. Privatization is a horrible thing from the start. And this is just another one of those opportunities to go, their stocks were north of $600. Really? And how are they getting that? They're getting it by bringing in lots of profit. And that profit is what? healthcare dollars that aren't being spent on granny and families that need it. That's the frightening part of all of this. And until we wake up to the reality that we're getting ripped off, they're going to continue doing it. But I'm going to be interested to see how this investigation plays out. And, well, if anybody's going to jail, I know executives are fleeing. But anybody going to jail? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Thursday, the House Education and Workforce Committee's Subcommittee on Workforce Protection. This caught my attention because there's a subcommittee of the House Education and Workforce Committee, Subcommittee on Workforce Protections. They held a hearing, and the title of the hearing, very Trumpian or Orwellian, however you want to frame that. The title is Reclaiming OSHA's Mission, Ensuring Safety Without Overreach. So you're led to believe that everything that's done, especially by that last administration, massive overreach. And one of the folks who testified on Thursday as to what's really going on, our good friend Jordan Barab was there fighting for the working folk, as I would have expected. You may remember Jordan was a former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA in his wheelhouse during the Obama years and took some folks to school. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, happy to be here again, Rick.
I got to tell you, a good job of all of the panelists, all the people that were there. You by far were the most knowledgeable, the most articulate, and, well, the most passionate about sticking up for workers.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not hard to know more than the other Congress people or even witnesses know in these kind of hearings.
Yeah. The weird thing here, though, is this is the guy who was the chairman of the committee started right out from the beginning going, you know, these regulations, I'm sure, may have been well-intended or have good intentions, but, and then you get to the buts of, you know, it's just bad for business kind of argument. And the help me here if I'm getting the sides right, because it seems like there's the argument between the political ideological divide of performance standards, meaning, you know, you're a good actor, so we're going to leave you alone, or having specific standards. Am I getting that kind of right?
Yeah, the performance standards are, you know, much more flexible. They kind of say, this is where we want to go. You figure out how to get there. You know, whatever you do is fine, just as long as you, you know, kind of try to do the right thing. And, you know, that works sometimes, you know, for very complicated issues like refineries. Process safety management standard is kind of a performance standard. It says you look for the best standards. You show us that you're doing the right thing. You show us that you've taken all these factors into account and just do it, because there's no way you can write a regulation that covers everything that goes on in a refinery or chemical plant. But, you know, when it comes to standards, you know, like, I mean, obviously fall protection or trenches or something, specification standards are needed. They tell you exactly what you have to do when you're on the roof or how low you can dig without protection. And the same thing with the main standard they were talking about today, which is heat. You know, there's some obvious things you have to do. You have to provide water, you have to provide shade. You know, you have to give them some time to acclimatize. rest breaks, the emergency response. These are the kind of things that every decent heat program has, and there's no reason, you know, to really make, you know, kind of one of these, you know, you just figure it out yourself standards, because everybody knows what has to be done to protect workers from heat. And the funny thing is, you know, small employers actually like specification standards better because it tells them exactly what they have to do. If they kind of just said, you know, you go out and figure it out yourself, then they have to hire someone to figure it out for them. So they really like these specification standards, unlike what, you know, most of the people in Congress who are really representing big business had to say today.
It was very interesting. And I look at, you know, Representative Comer asked a question of Mr. Parson. And when Mr. Parson answered, it was his response about the heat standards. Well, you know, when a worker needs a break, they just take one. You know, that kind of, hey, we're all big boys and girls. You know, we're going to take care of ourselves kind of argument. But the reality is in these workplaces where it's master and servant relations, you're not on equal playing fields. If you're tired or you need, you don't get to just wander off. That's kind of a simplistic view and not reality for too many workers.
No, they don't. What they don't understand are the politics and the power dynamic in workplaces. And you're right. I mean, workers can't just say, oh, I think I need to take a break now, or I need to go drink some, you know, find some water to drink. You know, plus they say, well, we should have a rule that just says take a break when you need it, drink water when you need it. You know, I mean, aside from what we just talked about, that workers may be intimidated from doing that. You know, a lot of times with heat, you don't know what's going on. You don't know you're dehydrated. You don't know, you know, that you may need a rest break. One of the symptoms of heat exhaustion and heat stroke is confusion. You don't really know what's going on or what will help you, nor do your coworkers. So, you know, it's stupid to think that workers can just, you know, figure it out for themselves when they're working, you know, in a 100 degree or 105 degree heat all day long. And especially if they don't feel free to, you know, to go find a drink of water or go take a break for 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, I had heard a story recently that, you know, because the confusion part was what was brought up. And I think it was somewhere in Texas where the employer just thought the guy was on drugs or drunk or something. Yeah. And the guy ended up dying because, well, they didn't know what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. And there was no one there to help that guy. And he didn't know because confused. That could have been any one of us.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a Department of Public Works employee who died of heat stroke in Baltimore last August. And it was same thing. He was kind of feeling funny all day. Didn't really know what it was. Then he started feeling dizzy and confused. And he actually went up to somebody's front door and said, help me, you know, I don't know what's going on with me. And you know, he collapsed and died, unfortunately. And his coworkers who had not been trained and he didn't know what to do. And they, even when they saw him getting sick, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know who to call, what was wrong with him. I mean, it was total, you know, a heat standard would have saved their lives.
Yeah, now I thought it was interesting that Comer at the end of his spiel then took a shot at the, you know, people in Congress and I guess folks like you, who the claim was they wouldn't know what it would be like to work for 15 minutes out in the heat. They don't know what it's like. And I go, look there, Representative Comer, I don't think that you know.
No, exactly. I don't know if it was Comer or someone else, but, you know, they went through their tirade about how terrible this was. And then he says, that's why people hate government. Well, you know, all people don't hate government. You may hate government, but the workers out there who are protected by government agencies like OSHA don't hate government, because those are the government agencies that are keeping them alive.
And also, you know, part of this hearing, as I understood it, is, you know, trying to keep government away from people, because, you know, during the Biden years, they instituted or trying to institute a walk-around standard to where, you know, if OSHA is going to inspect a facility, that there be someone a designee to walk around and show them what they're seeing. In union workplaces, that happens. But in non-union workplaces, it's generally whoever, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's whoever the company wants to be the representative, which I don't know that you really get to the bottom of what's going on.
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, what the law says is that workers in the plant can walk around, or they can have their designated representatives, which has usually been interpreted to mean the union. But, you know, OSHA was created 50 years ago, when there were a lot more unions around. And so they assumed, and the whole law is kind of based on the fact, on the assumption that most workers will be in union workplaces that OSHA inspects. Well, that's not what's going on today. You know, there are very few unions in workplaces, very few workers work in organized workplaces, but workers still need to have some kind of representatives walking around with the inspectors, because when an OSHA inspector comes, I mean, the workers may not even, you know exactly, you know, they may not be experts in the hazards they're facing. They may be afraid to talk to the OSHA inspectors and may want someone to help them, you know, talk to the OSHA inspector instead of them being seen by management and talking to the OSHA inspectors. And what we did, and then, you know, we did it by letter, but then the Biden administration put it in regulation. We said, yeah, I mean, workers should be able, they should be able to designate a representative even when they're not represented by a union. And this could be a workers' rights group, a COSH group. They should be able to get people to translate for them if they don't trust the OSHA translators, people who have more expertise. I mean, they should have the right to do that. And that's what we said. That's when, and again, the Biden administration put that into a rule. But these guys somehow think that's a secret, you know, way, you know, that OSHA is trying to help workers organize and bring unions in and create havoc. You know, actually, the funny thing is that the Mine Safety and Health Act allows workers to choose any representative they want to walk around with mine inspectors. There's never been a problem. They never have a problem with, you know, the miners trying to organize, you know, or, you know, creating havoc in the workplace, all this bullshit. I mean, as I said, you know, in my response, I said, it's all these objections are just red herrings.
You know, I look at this and again, you know, I'm watching this hearing and it's clear to me that the people, the Republicans aren't thrilled with the Oregon institution. It's clear to me that they're happy to see it be destroyed. But one thing did come out that I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, they asked the question that, you know, OSHA shouldn't be adversarial, that there should be a, you know, kind of a kumbaya business partnership. And while I agree with some of that, I do think OSHA has to be the cop on the beat. So it can't be all hand holding and sing-alongs. Do you remember that question?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we get that all the time. You know, the Democrats are always being accused of being too confrontational because we enforce the law. I mean, everybody enforces the law. It's the law. You know, if you comply with the law or you get penalized, you know, and penalties do actually have some effect. I mean, they're too low to have a whole lot of effect, except for, you know, small companies. For larger companies, they're just kind of the cost of doing business. But still, I mean, you want to, you know, you want them to have some disincentive. You want some deterrent effect. And that's, in fact, you know, what inspections and violations and penalties provide. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, we're driving down the road. Sure, you know, most people will follow the speed limit. You know, there's a lot of people that if they know there's no cop on the beat, they will drive as fast as they can. I mean, you know, I feel like I'm a good driver. I should be able to drive 10 miles over the speed limit all the time. But, you know, you don't do it because you're afraid you might get a ticket that might raise your insurance costs, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, you need that enforcement. And that's what Congress provided in the law. That's what OSHA is supposed to do, set standards and enforce those standards using penalties.
I just found the whole thing interesting because, you know, sadly, OSHA, in my view, and you can correct me if you're wrong, you're obviously the expert, fairly weak and fairly toothless in this moment. I think you said it would take, you know, nearly, what, two centuries to inspect every workplace in this country. So I find it interesting that they put up all of this stink and all of this fight and all of this anger and vitriol about an organization that, you know, chances are there's no cop on the beat. Chances are, unless someone dies, there's not going to be a lot of enforcement of things like I think you and I would want. So it seems curious to me. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think somebody, you know, mentioned that today, that, you know, unless somebody dies in your workplace or a worker has the courage to file a complaint, you know, any given employer is unlikely to ever see an OSHA inspector. So, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not even like, you know, getting caught for speeding again. There are a lot more cops out there, you know, looking for traffic violators than there are OSHA inspectors out there looking for workplace safety violators. You know, OSHA is, as I, you know, said in my testimony, you know, OSHA is just much too small. It's got a tiny budget, small number of inspectors, considering the large number of, you know, workplaces and workers it has to inspect. You know, it doesn't have enough money to really to issue standards. I mean, they're talking about regulatory overreach. The Biden administration did not issue one major standard in 4 years, not one. And it kind of pissed me off. But anyway, the point is, you know, we're hardly seeing this regulatory overreach that they complain about.
But that's the narrative, isn't it? I mean, just the fact that this organization, this administration, OSHA exists, that's the overreach. The fact that its mere existence is the overreach. Because like you said, the Biden OSHA didn't really do anything.
Yeah, no, they'd like to have some, you know, some kind of agency that would just pass out fact sheets and do training and, you know, pat everybody on the head. You know, it's, unless maybe there's a giant disaster and 10 people get killed or something. They don't understand, you know, that again, there's over 5,000 workers get killed every year. That's like 100 every week. Nobody has any concept of that's happening. And that's just people that die in the workplace. It is, you know, 20 times as many people die of occupational disease, which nobody notices or nobody sees. So there, you know, we have, you know, tragedies going on every day in workplaces around this country. But you know, people don't see it and they just kind of think that, you know, most, you know, maybe most employers do want to do the right thing, but you know, there's a whole lot of employers out there who are doing everything they can to cut corners and endanger workers. And that's why, you know, workers, even in this day, even though we have OSHA, you know, a lot of them are afraid to go to work in the morning. They're lucky to come home at night, safe and sound.
Now, one of the other things they talked about was this tree care rule. Explain what this tree care rule is, because, you know, I had always thought that there were some standards for people cutting down trees, climbing up and cutting trees. What's the rub here?
I have great sympathy for that. We do need a standard. I mean, there hasn't been a real tree care standard. There's a logging standard. There are various, you know, fall protection standards. There's electricity. There are all kinds of standards. OSHA never had a real tree care standard. And we were faced with a dilemma there. We thought, you know, we could do a tree care standard, but it's going to take a whole long time. Maybe we can cobble together with these other standards. We figured out when we were there that it didn't really work. And so we put tree care on the regulatory agenda, you know, when we were over there, and OSHA hasn't finished it, just like it hasn't finished, you know, dozens of other standards it's working on. The Tree Care Association, the Republicans love them. They've invited them to the last two hearings. They love them because this is one of the few associations that's advocating for a standard. And I can talk about why they're doing that. But it makes, you know, by highlighting this and highlighting that OSHA, you know, hasn't finished the standard, you know, they can kind of pretend that they're not totally anti-regulatory and anti-OSHA. And, you know, I talked to the tree care witness today. I talked to, there was a different tree care association witness last time. I said, you know, if you're really interested in getting the standard out, there's one reason the standard hasn't gotten out. It's because OSHA is so short of resources. If you really want this out, you should advocate and you should lobby for, you know, increases in OSHA's budget. And I talked to the guy before the hearing today. I said, you know, that's the solution, you know, more money. And when one of the Congress, you know, men asked him, you know, what can a Congress do? He didn't say anything about money. He just said, well, you know, just keep pressuring OSHA. I mean, they were kind of afraid to, you know, ask for that, but that is the problem. There just isn't enough money in staff, especially now that OSHA's lost 10% of its staff, you know, to really, you know, issue the standards that OSHA wants to issue and they're working on. And again, this is needed. I mean, I do my weekly toll every week, you know, lists of workers dying on the job, and not a week goes by that there isn't some kind of tree care person. Died on the job.
Either no, it's a crazy dangerous job, and you wouldn't catch me doing it. You know, and there should be. It's one of those things you go, how come there isn't one already? Which is why I had to ask you about that. Finally, yeah. I wanted to get your thoughts on something did surprise me. Representative Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin surprised me. He actually had a question for you, which most of these are more presentations than I think actual debates or hearings where Republicans ask their witnesses, Democrats ask their witnesses, and it's just a presentation. But Grothman actually asked you something about someone who was killed in his district. That kind of surprised me. Were you expecting that?
I was hoping for it. I mean, so the issue was OSHA is not allowed. There is a congressional rider that was put on OSHA's budget in the 1970s that forbids OSHA from setting foot for any kind of enforcement, investigations, anything on small farms, any farm with 10 or fewer people. That's been on OSHA's, you know, unfortunately, been a restriction since the 1970s. One of Congressman Grothman's constituents, Mitchell McDaniel, a 19-year-old, was killed on a small farm. He was basically ground up with an auger. And his mother, Stacy Sebald, has been very active in trying to eliminate this congressional rider. I just happened to have lunch with Stacy a couple of weeks ago, and she had said she had talked to Congressman Grothman, and he seemed to be interested in this issue. And we were kind of strategizing about how we can get rid of this rider. So I was kind of prepared. I knew he was on the committee. I was kind of hoping he would ask me about it. And sure enough, he did. So I was able to explain to him, you know, what the problem was, and that I was very, you know, well aware of his constituent who had lost her 19-year-old son.
Yeah, I'm a little jaded when it comes to these hearings because they're just political theater to me most of the times. I know you love them, and I know a lot of my friends do. But that was the moment of intrigue for me because there was an opportunity to actually do something. And for me, that the hearing was worth watching for just for that moment.
Well, hopefully he will do something about it. I mean, he's a very conservative Republican, you know, from Wisconsin. But hopefully, you know, this obviously, being as he asked about it, being he's met with Stacey several times, you know, maybe we'll pick it up and do something about it.
I'm not holding my breath, but maybe. Last question. Anything coming out of this? Is this just another one of those hearings where we say a lot of words and we don't actually accomplish much?
Probably. I think they just want to, you know, show to the business community that they're going to be hard on OSHA. So I don't expect a whole lot coming out of it, unless, of course, again, you know, Congressman Grothman decides to, you know, pick up this issue and really try to run with it. But usually these things just kind of go by with barely making a ripple.
For our Wisconsin audience, this is call him early, call him often, and say move this forward because this could be a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. At least I think so. Jordan, as always, great stuff. You did a fabulous job sticking up for working people and we're safe working conditions. Appreciate the time as always.
All right. Good to be here, Rick. Thanks.
Jordan Barab. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? Maybe get something done? I want to hear it right back after this. Stick around.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, we'll see cloudy skies, slight chance of showers this afternoon, a high around 57, northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, 37, still a bit breezy. Sunday, mostly cloudy, 51, highs near 60 on Monday.
It's 51 at our studios.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba.
Hello, Bluey.
Talking with our pal Stuart J. Waddles. This is an episode of Bluey that Stuart turned me on to. I like this show so much. Would it be weird if I left my wife, remarried, and had kids with someone else just so I could watch Bluey with my new set of kids?
I don't think it'd be that weird. I've heard a weirder.
You have?
Make a great story.
You get the exclusive.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm sure everyone has seen the news that Walmart is going to raise their prices, and they're saying, hey, we go in defense of the market. You know, the tariffs are coming. The tariffs are coming. So we got to raise prices. Which is interesting because the messaging that I'm getting from my red hat friends is inflation is non-existent. It's cooled significantly. Donald Trump did all that, flipped the switch in the Oval Office. And in fact, you got Axios out there reporting that there's hard data saying that tariff-driven inflation is overblown and the fear of recession equally overblown. In fact, they write, new data out Thursday shows steady retail sales and a surprising drop in wholesale prices in April. So far, so good. They got their fingers crossed. Now, as someone who does a lot of grocery shopping now, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the prices come down. As someone who knows people who rent housing, haven't seen those. My car insurance hasn't come down. So I'm not sure where all this happy talk is coming from. But here to share some thoughts on, well, what is the economy doing and what really is happening. I've asked our good friend Mateus Fernando to come share some thoughts. Mateus is a professor of economics at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
So I see Walmart, they're in defense of the market, which is one of the things I hate the most. We got to raise prices because we know what's coming. The tariffs are coming. We're going to raise the prices because, hey, we can.
Well, I mean, they certainly can to some extent. And the question of the tariffs, they know something we don't. I mean, if there is something that has been incredibly sort of uncertain is whether we're going to have tariffs and at what level he has changed tariffs, more frequently than he goes golfing. And so it's hard to know what will happen on that front. I mean, in all fairness, the report, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics report last Wednesday did show up prices coming a little bit down, closer to the Fed target of 2%. It's 2.3. You know, don't quote me on this. And it's a little bit higher if you exclude energy. So energy prices, because the price of oil internationally has sort of fallen. I should say, interestingly enough, not the price of utilities. So it's, you know, it's the price of energy, which, you know, has some impact, and certainly that's a helped, you know, keep prices under control. And when you look at the report, there are certain things that are still up, in particular, rentals, so housing. So the cost of that remains relatively high, and that's obviously a problem for working class people. But I will say, prices still, you know, the impact of the tariffs that may come or not has not been sort of felt. And I think that part of the story of what we were saying about the Fed is that the Fed has kept interest rates last week. You know, they kept the rates in place between 4.25 and 4.5, if memory doesn't fail me here. And that's negative for most working class people, because that's the sort of thing that keeps your insurance high, that keeps, mortgage rates high, that makes both housing unaffordable and renting, you know, expensive, and so on and so forth. So on the other hand, on the other piece that you talked, the recession, it is true that so far, in spite of the first numbers that we got for the first quarter, which were negative, slightly negative, minus 0.3% on GDP, the economy per se, you know, all of the predictions so far, you know, the objective data doesn't show a slowdown of the economy, in part because I should say one of the important things to remember here, Doge came, you know, Musk and you know, Trump promised to cut $1 trillion in you know, inefficiencies and so on and so forth, and they have fired people, they have hurt the economy significantly, but the spending has not come down. They continue to spend. They spend on, you know, on the things that are convenient to them. They have a budget that it's coming that will cut probably Medicaid, Medicare, you know, and so on and so forth. But they keep spending on the contracts for their friends and for themselves, in the case of Mr. Musk. So,
and to that point, Mateus, they're talking about what I'm looking at is upwards of a $5 trillion budget deficit. So they're actually talking about spending more money just on rich people and corporate handouts, and not for things
and cutting
that working
taxes
class
for
people
wealthy too. We have to remember that all of this is to make sure that they cut taxes by the end of the year. They make the tax cuts that he passed in the first, in his first administration permanent.
Right. No. See,
this is the government for the billionaires, by
right,
the billionaires.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is where I put the tax cuts in the spending category. We're spending money to enrich rich people. tax cuts to me is spending
cutting,
money.
Doge and the cutting of IRS staff, which also is just a handout. It's easier for, I mean, my income tax comes from my payroll taxes. You know, I don't have to do much. I mean, you know, I'm one of those that favor we should have directly, you know, the IRS a form and that's already in there. And, you know, my taxes are coming from my salary. But if you're a billionaire, you know, there are many ways of not paying taxes, and not having anybody at the IRS to check on your taxes is a good way of making sure you don't pay taxes. So that is also to favor, you know, the billionaire class.
Well, I mean, if you look at everything in this budget that we know so far of what they've let out, it is all about redistributing wealth to the very wealthy, or continuing that practice of enriching the very wealthy. And well, poor and lower class working folks, they're the ones who are going to end up paying more and have more obstacles in the way to get the services and the help that they need. Lives are going to get worse at the bottom of the scale, but at the top, things are never better.
Exactly. So bottom line, you know, sure, one can, that's why it's easy to spin this as there is no catastrophe yet. You know, nothing that, you know, will lead, if anybody thinks that that's the best sort of, you know, way that could happen to Democrats or, you know, to, you know, progressive, you know, interest in the country. But, you know, there is no collapse of the economy. Inflation is not going to run, you know, sort of crazy immediately. But, and the economy is probably just slowing down, but not collapsing. And one can paint that as a, you know, a sort of a relatively reasonable state for the economy. But the problem is that people at the bottom were suffering before, and they continue to do it, you know, right now. And so, and things are going to get worse. So I think that's the the effect of the policies that are, being put in place.
But I keep being told that, you know, they're not going to tax tips, they're not going to tax overtime, they're not going to tax Social Security, and yet none of those things are actually anywhere near this bill.
And then, you know, even if one favors some of those things, those are not the things that would make significant difference in the life of people.
Nope.
With all due respect. Those are minor things. So vigorous growth, support for, you know, higher minimum wage, for strong unions, redistributive policies that, you know, feeding children, giving them, you know, relatively easy and cheap access to health care. Those things have incredible access. I ought to say the pandemic, one of the things that happened during the pandemic, because we gave food to kids in, you know, in schools for free. We gave them access to health and whatnot. The poverty levels of children in this country collapsed. And then we took it away. And then poverty went up again. And so that's one of the things that I don't know how we are not going to learn that lesson. You know, the lesson we're learning is that inflation was a terrible thing, and that we're going to go back to keeping interest rates high to avoid terrible inflation. So I think that that's part of the wrong lessons we're learning from what happened over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I was watching a clip of Bruce Springsteen during one of his concerts, and he said, in America, they're persecuting people for using their right to free speech and voicing their dissent. This is happening now. He said, in America, the richest men are taking satisfaction in abandoning the world's poorest children to sickness and death. This is happening now. He said, in my country, they're taking sadistic pleasure in the pain that they inflict on loyal American workers. They are rolling back historic civil rights legislation that led to a more just and moral society. They are abandoning our great allies and siding with dictators against those struggling for their freedoms. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the boss, but, you know, we need more voices like that.
Yes, definitely. I saw him in Hershey, so not far from where you are a decade ago or so. But I tend to agree with that. I think that, part of the, again, you know, some of this is DOGE, the cutting and eliminating of USAID, which distributed money to many places in developing countries, and that would have a significant impact on many poor populations around the world. And as you were saying, there are many other things, you know, that, you know, go hand in hand with this kind of it's a government that, you know, interestingly enough, has had support for ideas that working class people, and you know, that's why they did get significant amounts of votes from parts of the working class people, and not just the white, you know, working class people. So there were bigger numbers, let's put it this way, of Hispanics and African American communities, in part because they have talked about some of the issues that, you know, we should care, you know, quality of work and protecting certain, you know, types of jobs, manufacturing jobs in the United States, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the policies don't necessarily match the discourse. And I think that one of the things that has been clear with regard of tariffs, and I'm not saying that tariffs magically will solve, you know, and bring back manufacturing jobs in the United States per se. I think that the policies that Biden was pursuing were more rational in a way of trying to bring,
agreed,
you know, manufacturing jobs here, you know, more measured in certain places with significant incentives to produce things that, you know, were relevant, the chips, the CHIP Acts, and so on and so forth. But I think that what is clear now, you know, he backtracked almost completely on the tariffs on China, is that the original sort of discussion that this was just a strategy for negotiating is what really the tariffs are. So I think we're going to see these sort of weird ups and downs, but he has no significant interest in creating manufacturing jobs in the United States. And if he had, you know, that interest, he wouldn't want them to be union jobs that would actually be good jobs. So that's the sort of thing that I think we should learn from these last negotiations with China and Geneva, that basically, you know, reduced the tariffs again for you know, a significant period of time.
Now, look, as I've been saying, look, I'm in favor of using tariffs strategically. I think they're an important tool. I don't think they're the only tool, and I've had a lot of people tell me that this was going to be it. Trump was going to use these tariffs, and it was going to create all this stuff, and I haven't seen it yet. I have seen some quote-unquote deals, but they haven't looked... I'm sorry, they're not setting the world on fire as far as I'm concerned. A lot of it was stuff that was already happening and that the Biden administration had already done.
Yes, I wouldn't expect... So let's absolutely clear. I don't think manufacturing jobs will come back to the U.S. because of Trump. So I think that, that's a false narrative, and I don't think that that's his intention. This was, I guess, at the end of the day, just a rhetorical ploy, you know, to get votes. And he does a lot of stuff, then, you know, very little consequences to what he does, and the effects are insignificant. So I think he'll claim that, you know, he will. that's for sure. There is a parallel reality in which, you know, manufacturing jobs are back in the United States already, and everything is great, and you know, we're building steel plants and whatnot. But you know, the reality is that it's very unlikely that that will happen. And actually, in many ways, he's weakening, you know, the not just the American economy, but the situation of working class people in the country.
I got to go back to this Jerome Powell thing, because you know, this idea how it's been framed is reconsidering monetary policy and the strategies and all of that. When you hear, you know, the Federal Reserve saying things like that, that they've got to figure out how to review their policy frameworks and their goals and all this stuff, what does that mean to you? For someone like me, I understand it's coded language. For smart people like you, this is your world. It could mean something enormous, could mean something insignificant. What are you hearing when you hear them say that?
So let me first say, I think that that's a perfect place to say that John Robinson, who was a student of Keynes, you know, a famous economist in England in the 20th century, she used to say that the reason to study economics is to avoid being deceived by economists. So when you say that, you know, you hear this stuff, it's jargon, I'm not sure what they're doing, it's probably they have their hand, you know, check your pockets. You know, that would be my... So the changes that Powell says they're going to revise are changes that were done right before the pandemic, around 2019, 2020, in which they said, look, this target of 2% inflation, we're not sure it's the best way to look at it, you know, at this. We shouldn't be keeping interest rates high just to avoid inflation that, you know, perhaps is not hurting anybody and everybody is okay. So we're going to now be more concerned, you know, inflation over a long period, if it's around that level, we're fine, but we're going to be more concerned with other things, including, you know, as it is in their, you know, charter to take care of things like employment and so on and so forth. What they're saying, the coded message in this is, look, we didn't learn the inflation. We were late at hiking interest rates. That's why inflation was high, which is not true. Inflation was high because of the pandemic and the snags in the supply chain. So we didn't have chips. The price of cars that use chips went up because we used for something else, and you know, and they were scarce, and that's why prices went up. So it was a supply side problem. And the war in Ukraine pushed, you know, the price of fertilizers and gas and oil and, you know, up, and the cost of production went up. So that's the reason for inflation. It wasn't the Fed. And it came down not because the Fed hiked interest rates. It came down simply because, you know, the snags in the supply chain vanished. Pandemic ended, you know, ports open and so on and so forth. And, you know, the price of oil came down. It went up, but then it came down because essentially the oil from Russia and Ukraine and whatnot started flowing and other places produced. And so we're fine again. So that was it. The Fed didn't do a thing. What the Fed did is they hiked interest rates. And they almost threw us into recession. They didn't. You know, we escaped the so-called, you know, soft landing.
Right.
You know, that's code for that. We escaped the recession, which they would have provoked with for, you know, no reason. But, you know, they're very happy with the high interest rates. The high interest rates, and, you know, it's something that in general financial markets want. Imagine, if you have almost zero interest rates, all the other assets are having very low rates. And these people leave from, you know, interest rates, you know, on their assets. They're very wealthy. So higher interest rates are not necessarily a bad thing for wealthy people. But for working class people, they're terrible, because what they mean is, you know, higher mortgage rates, higher, you know, high insurance costs, higher rental, you know, and so on and so forth. So what he's saying is we're going to go again into a frame of policy that favors financial markets and not working class interests. And so that's the discussion it's a discussion also in which Trump has, in his way, a mix of incompetence and craziness, promoted this idea that he should tell the Fed what to do, and has had financial markets very nervous about that. But I should say he's not completely wrong in the following sense. There is a reason that we should be more concerned about the independence of the Fed, because the Fed tends to be an agency that thinks only on the interest in the interest of Wall Street. It's most of the people that are at the Federal Open Market Commission and decide on interest rates, they come from the banks themselves, because they come from the structure of the Fed, which is owned by the banks, the regional banks are. And they appoint people that normally, like Powell, have worked in Wall Street. And so their interests are aligned with the interest of Wall Street. There is no representative of, there's no union representative at the table discussing interest policy in the United States. And people say, why there should be? Why shouldn't there be?
Right.
It's something that affects everybody's life. So my point is, sure, I think that Trump is not incorrect in saying that there should be other interests. I'm not sure I want Trump to be the voice at the table discussing interest rates. But I think it is something that we should be discussing, and he's opening the door for us to discuss the possibility that we have a different structure in which other voices are heard when we make monetary policy decisions in the United States.
I'm not, because I was going to ask you, and you kind of stepped over my question, was because I have a lot of my redhead friends that said we should be destroying the Fed, and crushing it to the ground and getting rid of it. Do you have a thought on that?
I think it's a terrible idea. I think the Fed, Mariner Eccles was the chairman of the Fed during the FDR. So from 1934, when it gets reformed the year later in 35, he's effectively the first chairman of the Fed until 1948. And it's a period of great of recovery, of booming economy, of the creation of the middle class. Economists call it the Great Compression, is when income inequality is eliminated and the middle class emerges. And it's a period in which he actually talks explicitly about the Fed being an instrument of helping. He creates the Federal Housing Authority, of financing houses at very cheap rates, of a financial system that works for productive forces and for working class people. So I think the Fed is a great instrument that has to be there, but it has to be managed in a democratic sort of way, in a way that they're accountable to what they do, that they go to Congress and explain what they're doing, and that Congress, on a regular basis grills them when they do things, and that the people that are elected appoint, a number of the people at the Federal Open Market Committee that makes the decisions on interest rates are appointed by the president. But even Democrats tend to appoint people that come from the financial sector. So they should be appointing, people that come from the, from the side of, the economist of the AFL-CIO should be appointed to. There's no reason that why they shouldn't. I mean, seriously, these are competent economists with PhDs and all of those sort of things that, important people should have, and they should be participating, but having the interest of a broader set of people, not just the financial stability and the well-being of banks, but the financial stability and the well-being of, of American people.
I'm right there with you. Great answer. Mateus, as always, informative, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our good friend, Mateus Vernango. Want to hear your thoughts. What are your thoughts? You agree with that? You working people on the board? I'm on board. We should be pushing for that. Where's your change.org petitions? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day we lost one of the giants of the U.S. labor movement, A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph spent his life working for black workers and the cause of labor. He organized the first national black union to be recognized by the American Federation of Labor, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The fight for union recognition took 12 years, and the Porters signed their first contract in 1937. Randolph went on to lead the effort to desegregate war industries and armed services during and after World War II. He was one of the leading organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, one of the most memorable actions of the civil rights movement. He also worked tirelessly to break down discrimination within the labor movement. He was elected the first black vice president of the AFL-CIO in 1955. Randolph's dedication to the cause of labor was summed up when he said, quote, "The essence of trade unionism is social uplift. The labor movement has been the haven for the dispossessed, the despised, the neglected, the downtrodden, the poor." But Randolph also consistently declared that no movement for social justice can be complete unless it is also inclusive. While organizing for the desegregation of the war industries during World War II, Phillips argued, quote, "Equality is the heart and essence of democracy. Freedom and justice, equality of opportunity in industry, in labor unions, schools and colleges, government, politics, and before the law. There must be no dual standard of justice, no dual rights, privileges, duties, or responsibilities of citizenship. No dual forms of freedom." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I like Mateus's idea of working class people at the Federal Reserve. It's a good idea. It's been a good idea for a very long time, something that I've talked about in years past. Whenever my red hat friends, you know, "We need to crush the Fed." I'm going, "No, we need to take it over." It's like any tool. It's like tariffs. You use it the right way, it's going to do great things. And as he pointed out, you know, FDR's Fed chair did a great job of building the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity by having a balanced kind of approach. Having, you know, an inclusive monetary policy where you have worker representatives at the table pushing for you know, employment and wage growth. How can that be a bad thing? Because the Fed has a dual mission: inflation, jobs. You know, it's that balancing act. And what do they do to when the economy is getting heated up, when too many jobs are being created? They raise inflation to make sure enough people get laid off. Maybe if you had working class voices there, maybe we'd re-examine that balance between inflation and employment goals. Maybe if you had that working class perspective there, maybe that dual mandate of maximizing employment and stabilizing prices, maybe that has some real world reality to it. Maybe. Maybe you might have a little more nuanced decision-making process so that the purchasing power and job security of workers is a little more considered than just, hey, you know. And maybe we start talking about, you know, wages and labor market conditions. We take on issues like wage stagnation, labor rights, working conditions. Maybe there's an opportunity, because Wall Street sure knows how to use that tool to enrich themselves, which could make it that, you know, we enhance democracy. We give some legitimacy and accountability, some transparency to what's going on. And maybe we talk about how we promote an economy for all, equitable and stable. You know, ask the question, you know, what's an economy for? And what good is it if a large percentage of your workers are struggling to make ends meet or need help from our government? I think overall, if we could get more working class voices, not just at the Federal Reserve, but everywhere, we could have that more inclusive, balanced, socially conscious society and, well, at least economic policy. But we're not going to do that because, well, the bankers, the billionaires, it's a tool of control for them. And Mateus is right. You know, they like higher interest rates because they can just sit back and roll in the dough. While we're paying higher rents, higher mortgage rates, higher credit card rates, higher car loan rates, higher all that. something worth maybe when Democrats take over down the road, maybe something we should be considering. And maybe when Democrats do take over, maybe not putting people like Larry Summers there. Just my thought. Want to hear yours, though? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something I said got on your nerves, under your skin, or made you happy or sad. Want to hear about it? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. A manhunt continues for seven inmates who escaped from a New Orleans jail Friday morning. Three others were captured within hours of the brazen escape. ABC's Christian Cordero has the how.
The sheriff says that some of the inmates began tampering with that lock cell door, and then they were seen, that was right around 12:20, and then they were seen on surveillance footage entering that cell about 20 minutes later. 20 minutes roughly after that, the inmates exited the jail through a wall behind a toilet. They weren't reported missing until around 8:30 a.m. during a routine headcount.
Authorities say the inmates likely had help from the inside. Widespread destruction and grief in the South and Midwest after severe storms tore through, killing at least 23 people in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia. President Trump, in an online post, says he'll hold a phone call with Russia's President Putin Monday and then Ukraine's President Zelensky after direct talks on a ceasefire deal broke down Friday. This is ABC News. The third.